Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 18th, 2015, and please let the record show that we do have a quorum. Members, we have three bills on our agenda today dealing with agriculture. And just so members and people in the audience understand that the last bill, my bill, Senate File 482, we will not take any formal action on today. We're going to start the discussion. I was hoping we could add a little bit more agreement on that, but at this point, it's still a work in progress. So I'd like to let the committee listen to both sides of the testimony, and then we can bring it back at a later date. But first on our agenda, we have Senator Saxog, Senate File 517. Senator Saxog, welcome to the committee.
Can I do that?
I think so.
Right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 517, and Mr. Chair, the A4 amendment.
Okay. Members should have the A4 amendment in their possession. It's an author's amendment. This is the first committee the bill has been to, so... Senator Bonhoff moves the A4 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Saxog, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill takes advantage of Minnesota's abundant forestry and agricultural feedstocks to enable commercial-scale production of advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and biomass-based heat. With me today are Brendan Jordan of Great Plains Institute, Biochemistry Coalition of Minnesota, Bridget Tuck, University of Minnesota Extension, John Warren, Central Minnesota Renewables Green Biologics, and Doug Busselman of the Minnesota Farm Bureau. And they're all going to give a few brief presentations and then help me answer any questions.
Sounds wonderful. Whichever one of you would like to go first, just introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brendan Jordan. I am with the Great Plains Institute, and I represent the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota. I was asked to give a brief walkthrough of the bill. So, first of all, the coalition is a multi-stakeholder group representing a variety of different perspectives across the state, geographically, and also a lot of range of views. You do have a list of coalition members in your packet. The mission of the coalition is to expand Minnesota's renewable chemical, advanced biofuel, and biomass thermal energy industries. The approach that this bill takes is a production incentive approach, which really would help to build an industry by rewarding successful projects with a production incentive, without offering upfront money, and with in an approach that manages risk to the state of Minnesota. As noted, three types of projects would be eligible for the production incentive. Advanced biofuels, those are those fuels that are designated by the U.S. EPA as advanced biofuels and meeting the low carbon requirements under the EPA rules. Renewable chemicals, which are basically displacements for petroleum-based chemicals made from renewable resources. And then biomass thermal, which is biomass heat, which is targeted at areas of the state that are interested in diversifying their sources of heat, such as areas not served by natural gas. The bill is divided into three sections along those lines. First section being for advanced biofuels, the next being for renewable chemicals, the third for biomass thermal energy. Eligibility is determined in part by when the facility starts up, so it's really encouraging new production. A facility must come online no earlier than July 1st, 2015. And there's a 10-year window for new facilities to start up operating. The incentive is available for an individual facility for a 10-year period, and there's strong encouragement to source local materials from Minnesota. 80% of materials must be from Minnesota, with an exception for facilities that are close to the border, and it must still be within a 100-mile radius. Minimum production levels, the bill is intended to encourage commercial-scale projects, so there is a minimum level you must have production above some level in each of the three categories. There is also a cap on the level of incentive that can go to an individual facility. There are also caps within each section capping the number of facilities that are eligible to receive an incentive. Rather than walk through the levels of incentive, I can elaborate on that if there are any questions. I would like to address a couple of provisions related to sustainability. First of all, the coalition is very interested in seeing the adoption of perennial crops and cover cropping systems. As a result, there are bonus payments for the utilization of those feedstocks if they are commercially available in the marketplace. We also, in the forestry section, there are the bill lays out criteria for the utilization of sustainably certified feedstocks using guidelines that have been accepted and used in Minnesota for a long time. There is also language about a responsible biomass sourcing plan in the A4 amendment that really puts the onus on those operating biofuel or chemical facilities. If they are sourcing agricultural biomass, puts the onus on them to have a plan to assure, for example, for corn stover, appropriate management to avoid damaging soil or increasing water quality issues. Does require that the plan be public. It requires annual reporting on whether the plan is being followed by producers in the program. I think that covers the walkthrough. Mr. Chair, members, I'm happy to take any additional questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Are there any questions for the witness?
Mr. Chair, do we know where that feedback's coming from?
We've had trouble in this room with feedback for a while, so I'll place a call, see what we can do.
Okay, very good.
All right, thank you. Try to work through it. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Bridget Tuck. I am with University of Minnesota Extension. Extension is the outreach arm of the university. And in particular, I work with community economics. So our mission is to help communities make informed economic decisions using data. So that's why I'm here today. Great Plains Institute was interested in understanding a little bit more about the potential for bio-based industrial products and the economic contribution in Minnesota. And that is what I researched. The research is summarized in a report that is in your folder. It's called The Economic Contribution of the Bio-Based Industrial Products Industry in Minnesota, A Look to the Future. I'm going to be referencing comments from the executive summary. I encourage you, though, to read the full report if you're interested in a few more details about the report and about the analysis. So what we were asked to do is look at the potential for 14 new facilities. There were seven companies that are looking to base themselves here in Minnesota and to build facilities. So we were able to survey them and get information about their expenditures and their plans for Minnesota. And we used that then to replicate up to 14 plants. So we had information for seven, and we thought some of them might be able to have two or three of those kinds of facilities in Minnesota. Maybe some of the others would only be one. And so we did do that. Look at the 14. And if those 14 were to become fully functional in Minnesota, so maybe at year three or four when they're at full operation, they would spend $470.3 million annually in the state. Of that, $36.8 million would be on labor income, so spending for wages, salaries, and benefits. And they would employ at their facilities 590 people. Now, we know as businesses spend money in the economy, that creates ripple effects, and so we see some additional supply chain effects. And when we add that in, we get the total economic contribution would be an estimated $837.6 million. That includes $174.1 million in labor income, so money into to the residents of Minnesota, and it would support jobs for 3,190 Minnesotans. And we know that is nice to see that big number and to have that total number. But what's also very instructive sometimes is to understand where those ripple effects are. So what are the industries that would be feeling the highest impacts? $900 jobs in the logging industry, so a rather big impact for that, as well as that there would be about 500 farmers that would receive some, would make sales to these facilities and receive some of their income from those facilities. And then we also have one of the companies that we looked at is headquartered here in Minnesota, so you see some research and development jobs as well related to biotechnology. And those are ongoing impacts. Those are impacts that would be felt on an annual basis as long as those facilities were operational. We also have some construction impacts. So during the time period of construction, they would end at the end of the construction period. But they, during that construction period, it would contribute $1.5 billion to the Minnesota economy. That includes $538 million of labor income and would support jobs for 8,690 people in the state. Kind of a quick summary of the research that we did. I'm happy to answer any questions. I appreciate your attention today.
Thank you very much for your very detailed report, and obviously members will have that in their packets, and we appreciate you going through that for us this afternoon. Any questions for the witness? Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is John Warren, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Green Biologics, and I'd like to say that our company's really excited to be here in Minnesota, and what really drew us to Minnesota was the success in the past, successes of the biofuels and forest product industries. It sets a great example for, I think, what Minnesota can do going forward. We really think these industries complement the renewable chemical production industry. That's what our business is involved in. And we do look forward into doing business in Minnesota. Minnesota has some great agricultural resources. That's another reason that drew us to the state. When we looked around, the company cast a very wide net when it was looking at potential sites, and Minnesota and Little Falls in particular really rose to the top. Commercial-scale renewable chemicals are really expected to offer some enhancements and actually be cost-competitive with the petrochemical equivalents that they're gonna replace. But what happens with companies like ours and with companies in a similar situation is when you're trying to introduce these products into the markets, there's the market entry challenge. And our products are going to a range of markets, including some very high-value markets in the early years. It can take some time to develop those markets, and there can be some economic growing pains. So we think this this bill is very important. We believe the bill opens the door to diversify into new markets for existing industries in Minnesota, namely the forest product and the ethanol industries. As with biofuels, we believe Minnesota could really establish a leadership position with a policy like this. We believe it's a sound policy, and we think it sends a really clear signal to the commitment that the state has in developing an industry like that. Because it is a performance-based program, the state really has an opportunity to share in the success and the growth of the industry, because there's going to be a lot of money coming back into the state before any of the state incentive has to be paid out. With Central Minnesota Renewables in particular, it really does validate the Minnesota opportunity. It's a wonderful example how an existing facility can repurposed and diversify into new production areas. The Little Falls site in particular offers an established site with a lot of process equipment that can be reused. It's got existing utilities. It's got an established feedstock supply source, and it's got a very capable workforce. We're really excited about being in Little Falls. The community has been wonderful to work with. The folks that have been involved with CMEC and all the way around it's been a great relationship, and we look forward to continue to develop that and do something really good in Little Falls. A lot of that process equipment is going to be reused, and in the handout you can see a site diagram, and that really does depict how little impact that this type of project is going to have on the existing facility. To those driving by the road, they won't even be able to see the difference after the construction is done. There will be some new distillation equipment required, but most everything else at the site will be able to be reused. And the other thing that does is it allows the plant to continue to operate as an ethanol plant and continue to be productive for the community while the project is taking place. Got some really wonderful marketing opportunities. There are a huge spectrum of products that our butanol and acetone will go into. A lot of very popular end products and consumer products. And I'd like to just list off a couple of the ones that we are targeting. And a lot of these you probably notice as already having a presence in Minnesota. Architectural paints, inks and toners, household cleaners, adhesives and sealants, charcoal lighting fluids, heating fuels and lamps, cosmetics and toiletries and other personal care, food ingredients and flavors, plasticizers, and lubricants and adhesives. Very excited to be here and be glad to take any questions.
Mr. Warren, thank you for your testimony and for all the exciting things that are taking place up in Little Falls. That's pretty interesting stuff. Any questions for Mr. Warren at this time? If not, thank you very much for coming today and for your testimony. Next, I think we're going to hear from the Minnesota Farm Bureau. Mr. Busselman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Doug Busselman, Minnesota Farm Bureau. Minnesota Farm Bureau supports the development of an advanced biofuels industry and believe that this incentive-driven approach provided in this bill will responsibly accomplish this objective. Beyond the merits of opening opportunities for residue resources, there are also value-added incentives for renewable chemical production. We also think that it's a very positive move to include the use of forest products and other biomass products in this comprehensive program. We support the bill and hope you will too.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think that's the end of Senator Saxog's presentation. So there's a couple more people that would like to be heard, but do members have any questions right now they'd like to ask of Senator Saxog? Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saxog, will this bill cover biobutanol?
Senator Saxog, or your witnesses?
Yeah, Senator Dames, I'm going to Mr. Jordan to answer that question.
Yes, biobutanol would be an eligible product under this program.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. So there's a couple of ethanol plants that have started the process and they're in the middle of the process of converting. Would they be eligible for some of these funds if they qualified?
Mr. Jordan?
As long as they're not above a certain threshold prior to the date in 2015, they would be eligible. So we did want to structure the program so that a project that's only operating at pilot scale could receive an incentive for scaling up. And I believe that covers the projects that are in question in Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Thank you, sir. Any other questions right now? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Steve Morris from the Minnesota Environmental Partnership would like to testify. And I believe there's one other person from the St. Croix Watershed Station. If you guys would like to come forward, please. Okay.
Thank you, committee. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Sean Schottler. I'm with the St. Croix Watershed Research Station. We are a field research station of the Science Museum of Minnesota. I'm a senior scientist there, and I'm also a farmer with my dad of 320 acres. My principal research works on trying to understand what has changed water quality over time and what can change water quality in the future, both positively and negatively. The current renewable fuels mandate standard requires 16.9 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol to be made by 2025. That could impact 80 million acres of land throughout the Midwest. Therefore, its potential to change water quality and the landscape is huge. The plan that has been laid out in this bill shows some examples of sustainable harvest of stover. However, at best, those guidelines represent no net negative impact to water quality. And that's with the assumption that the science is right on that. And there's plenty of science to show that there's a real potential for both nitrate increases from the harvesting of cellulosic biomass, corn stover, as well as certainly degradation to soil health and storage of organic carbon. Even if the negative impacts to water quality are small, and that is at best uncertain, the landscape scale is huge, and therefore the impact to our water quality could be very large, both nutrients and soil erosion. This is not to say that I'm against cellulosic ethanol. The fact is, I think it represents a real opportunity. It's the corn stover portion that's in question. There are other feedstocks, and I passed around an example of alfalfa that present us with a real opportunity. Alfalfa, the stems can be used for the cellulosic feedstock. The leaves are high in protein and can be stripped for livestock feed. It's perennial, so it holds the soil. Because it's being used for a cellulosic source, the harvest date is mid-June, which means you get the first nesting of ducks and pheasants and songbirds. And it's a flowering plant, so it provides pollinator habitat. And the other magic is alfalfa, because it fixes nitrogen in rotation with corn, provides about 150 pounds to the acre nitrogen credit, which means 1 out of 3 years in a corn rotation, you don't have to apply any nitrogen. That directly translates to decreased nitrate levels in our water, helping us to meet water quality standards. And the last thing I would say is that the corn stover exists. There are 3 cellulosic plants that are opening, 2 in Iowa, Poet and DuPont. The technology to process cellulosic feedstocks exists. If cellulosic ethanol, the mandate stays in place, and if it's a viable product, all of the elements are in place for corn stover ethanol to enter Minnesota all on its own without an incentive. The part that's missing is an incentive for the alternative feedstocks to provide us with a lot of benefits that corn stover feedstocks do not. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Morris, nice to see you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Steve Morris. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Environmental Partnership. The partnership is the largest coalition of environment and conservation organizations in the state. And you may notice that we are absent from this bioeconomy coalition, and I want to talk a little bit about why. My comments will be specifically to the ethanol portions of the bill, and largely because of Minnesotans' overwhelming concern for the quality of their drinking water and their lakes, rivers, and streams. Just a little bit of history. I know some of you know my history, but Mr. Knopf, I think, was here back in the late 80s when I was a new member to this committee, and we met in this room, and we established the original ethanol mandate that we have that was championed by Senator Dave Frederickson, now Commissioner Frederickson. I was a supporter of that, and we moved it through for a lot of good reasons, some of which you're hearing now. In the 90s, I moved on to be chair of the Agriculture and Environment Budget Division and championed the ethanol payments and the expansion of the system and the construction of the incentive system that we have in place for conventional ethanol. After I left the Senate, my education on these issues continued, and I've watched the industry evolve, and my thinking has certainly evolved also. The landscape that we have in Minnesota now is increasingly dominated by 2 summer crops of corn and beans. And what we know is that during the summer, those crops soak up the water and the nutrients and have very modest impact on water quality. But that's only a few months out of the year. The other months of the year, the soil is largely bare. It doesn't absorb the water, doesn't absorb the nutrients, doesn't have the active roots. And that's where we get a lot of erosion and runoff that occurs. Six out of seven, or roughly 86% of our water quality impairments in Minnesota are caused by non-point source pollution such as this, largely agricultural pollution. So this has helped me to evolve my thinking. Because whether it's phosphorus, sediment, or nitrogen in our waters, we have a very steep hill to climb in order to restore our state's water quality, which is one of our state's top priorities. We simply can't do this without new and better strategies. For example, to reach the 45% nitrogen reduction goal in the MPCA's nutrient reduction strategy, the agency estimates that more than half of those reductions will need to come from incorporating perennials and cover crops into our watersheds. In fact, it's a major strategy for our other pollutants also. We can go the regulatory approach with water regulations and how we manage our crops, but perhaps the biggest opportunities are in looking at market-based measures such as cellulosic ethanol that will, in fact, improve water quality and can be achieved through the marketplace. We need to develop new and smarter ways to avoid farm runoff on the front end. Cellulosic ethanol represents a major expansion for the ethanol industry in the state, but we are missing a major opportunity if we do not focus this developing industry where it can provide more options for farmers, more crops, more diversity on the fields, and the most benefits for our state, especially with our state dollars. By using perennial crops to fuel these new facilities, we can build soil health and improve soil water storage capacity, which is increasingly important. Improve water quality dramatically, provide habitat for wildlife and things such as pollinators, and provide more forage for livestock producers. Adding further incentives to continue our over-reliance on a few select crops is not a wise strategy for the future of our state or our great outdoors. We must seize this opportunity that's presenting itself to develop systems that will provide multiple economic and conservation benefits for years to come. We cannot support this legislation as it is drafted. We are ready to work on this proposal so that it provides those multiple benefits. But for the betterment of the state for the long term, we have to make sure that the program is focused on perennials and cover crops and moves us in the direction of more diversification of our landscape and our economy. Be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris, for your testimony. Any questions for the two witnesses?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do have a little fact sheet if we could share.
Okay, we'll get that handed out, certainly.
Some of the concerns.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this the time to ask a question of the author of the bill?
I believe that would be okay, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Saxhog, I was just noticing that there's a 4.5% of the appropriation can be used for administration. That's a rather high percent. Usually it's about 2%. And so I'm just wondering, why is this 4.5%? It's really a high percentage for administration.
Senator, Mr. Jordan?
Well, all right. Mr. Chair, I would refer to, and Senator Nelson, thanks for your question.
Yes. Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have run that figure by the department. Certainly, we'd be open to talking about the appropriate percentage for administration of the program. I would probably have to defer to the Department of Agriculture on exactly what is needed to administer the program.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson?
Just a comment. I can understand why the department would think that's an appropriate fee, but I think we need to have some understanding about why that's higher than the usual fee for administration.
Okay. We can have a discussion. This bill has a few more stops, I think, Senator Nelson, okay. If that's okay. Yeah. If that's okay with you, I think you bring up a valid point, but thank you. Any other questions for Senator Saxhog? I guess Mr. Knopf has a technical change that he needs to make. Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chair and members, in putting together this bill, Mr. Jordan and I have kind of gone back and forth, and we've added some things and taken away some things, and we tried to keep the language parallel, and while we were sitting here, I caught one that was not parallel between the three programs, and I thought it might be nice to fix that now while I've noticed it now. Because when Mr. Jordan was describing at the beginning about that 100-mile radius, you'll see on 2.10 it says may. The same language is on 3.29, it says must. And the same language is on 5.13, it says should. Well, we don't want to use should, I know that. And I'm thinking that what you're talking about here is may, because we say it can be anywhere in the state.
but we're allowing the 100 miles. So I'm thinking May is the proper term in all three places. So I think the amendment would be on 3.29, delete must and insert may, and then on 5.13, delete should and insert may. And I think that would make them consistent. I think it would actually make sense where you're basically saying it has to be from within the state, but if you're within 50 miles of the border, you can go outside of the state for that 100-mile radius, but we're not going to limit you to the 100-mile radius if you're on the border because other people can be anywhere in the state. It seems to make sense to use the word may in that situation.
Senator Saxon,
Mr. Chair, I'd request that amendment be added.
Members understand the oral amendment. Senator Vonoff will move the oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Okay. Any further discussion on Senate file? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that I'll get to see this bill again before it comes to the floor. So I just wanted to ask the author or one of his testifiers. This was presented to me. It sounds very exciting. And I was quite interested in the renewable aspect and especially the chemical of renewables. But my question was, as I looked at the information, it didn't appear that there was going to be – the only way that this would be competitively priced is with the subsidy. And so when we did ethanol production, you know, we had the ethanol subsidies to get the industry up and running, and then the product itself was sustainable upon the market. It had a market. It was competitive on the market. And so my question is this going to be competitive on the market without subsidy?
Mr. Jordan or Senator Saxon?
Well, I'll take the first shot, okay. And then Brendan can cover for me after. But I'd say this, that I think what we're doing with this with these grants are trying to kind of leapfrog the pilot portion and try to get to the production portion of this industry without having to go through that whole pilot portion. What do you – is that fair?
Mr. Jordan, is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, members, I would refer you to the renewable chemicals handout that's in your packet, which talks about what we mean by renewable chemicals. They could potentially have a wide variety of markets, including, plastics, 3D printing. There's a company in Minnesota, actually, that produces a renewable plastic that is the most popular plastic for 3D printing, specialty chemicals, paints, household chemicals. In most cases, these products do need to stand on their own in the marketplace. They do not benefit from the kind of policy like a federal renewable mandate. They do have to stand on their own in their market. And in many cases, these products actually perform as well or better than the incumbent technology. There are growing markets for more renewable-type chemicals in Europe and parts of the United States where they do have an interest in phasing out certain products for a variety of reasons, some concerning human health concerns and other issues. The other thing I'll just note is that the benefit of a production-based incentive is it doesn't require the state to make decisions about technology. It simply rewards success. So a project must still persuade an investor to lend them money. They must still have good technology. They must get a project up and running, and they must have a market. Otherwise, they simply won't receive an incentive. That's why the coalition has gravitated towards the production incentive approach as really a way to protect Minnesota taxpayers and assure that money is not going towards a project that doesn't end up happening.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So my question, though, is without the incentives, whether it's per pound or per MMBTU, without those incentives, then are these products, would they be competitive on the market?
Mr. Jordan?
Mr. Chair, Senator, The intention of the program is to help jumpstart new technology and new industries. So it is certainly our belief that these companies, these technologies, will stand on their own at the end of the incentive period, but that because they are new technologies and incentives are being offered in other jurisdictions, it is important for those two reasons. One, you got to help the technology get over that hurdle to get into the marketplace and compete with incumbents that have been there for years and have their costs driven really far down by having paid for all their infrastructure. That's one reason. The other reason is there are other jurisdictions that are offering similar incentives. So Minnesota needs to stay competitive. For example, Governor Branstad in Iowa offered a renewable chemical incentive in his State of the State address, and there is a bill in the Iowa legislature this session. There are similar incentives in other states as well. So I think those are the two reasons. One is you got to get over that commercial hurdle. I think this helps, and I think they'll stand on their own after they get through the program. Number two, we got to be competitive. We got to have these projects here in Minnesota.
Thank you. One follow-up, Mr. Chair. So you did answer my question. Thank you very much. And so then how long does this incentive last? I didn't actually see that in the bill summary.
Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Senator, for an individual project, the incentive lasts for a 10-year period. Now, there is a little bit longer window of time for projects to start. We basically give them a 10-year period to get up and running. Once this is out on the street, it will take some time for projects to initiate, so we want to have a window of time to let people who are working in DEED and other places who are trying to recruit companies to do their work and get projects started. But they would have to start up by 2025, and that would be and so then the program would end in 2035.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Senator Bonham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jordan, I just wondered if you could have any comments with regard to what Mr. Morse said.
Mr. Jordan?
Mr. Chair, Senator, absolutely. I would say that from the perspective of the coalition, and it represents a whole wide range of views, we share many of the interests of the two testifiers. We share the belief that perennial crops offer great promise, not just to create diversity on the landscape, but also to provide potentially better income on potentially some marginal acres. There might be some places where alfalfa or switchgrass does really well, where conventional crops aren't doing as well. They also do certainly offer benefit for water quality issues. So, I mean, I agree with all those things. And I think from the perspective of the coalition members, there's broad agreement. I think where there's a difference of opinion is just what it takes to actually deploy those feedstocks. And it is our firm view that with something like a switchgrass, for example, you need to have a market before producers are going to experiment with those types of feedstocks. We believe that it's very important to establish that market. This bill does that. Once you had, for example, a cellulosic ethanol plant in your community and you know that they're buying biomass and they know what they're paying for it, sure, you might experiment with some new things. There's been a lot of interest in the state of Minnesota in perennial feedstocks for a long time, but we have not seen that critical mass to plant them just because there hasn't been that market. I like to hear that Sean Schottler expressed the view that Stover can be managed well. We believe that the responsible sourcing provisions in the bill would result in good Stover management. Of course, we're going to have to learn as we go. Even the deployment of corn stover as a feedstock is a relatively new technology, a new approach. It's being done at a couple of facilities in Iowa, but we're going to learn as we go. But that really is the only way to learn and get better is by taking a shot at it. And I think that the bill has a lot of provisions really asking producers to come in every year and report to the state, how are you doing? And there are real teeth. So I think that it's a responsible approach given the situation we're in now. We don't have all the information about everything, but we'll learn as we go.
Senator Bonham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have much experience and knowledge in this area, so I just have been listening to the various testimony. So is there a way to include the alternative types of crops that were mentioned as part of the project so that, you know, if this is, seems like it's a long-term approach, is there a way to not leave them behind? I don't know if that's possible.
Ex-Senator Bonhoff, I believe, and actually Mr. Jordan can talk, but I think there's actually extra incentives for those new technologies if they are able to move forward. So they're certainly not excluded, but I it's your bill, so go ahead, Mr. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, that's absolutely right.
Thank you.
Things like switchgrass are eligible feedstocks under the program. There are existing pathways under the EPA rules for the renewable fuel standard, calculating the carbon intensity of those feedstocks. We actually, in this program, provide a 20% bonus for using either perennial feedstocks or for incorporating cover crops into a crop system where you would harvest stover. So I believe the bill goes a long way towards not just including but rewarding those types of feedstocks.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Okay, this has been a good discussion. I think Senator Coonan would like to move that Senate File 517 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Energy. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Eakin, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought I'd like to recognize a group that's visiting us today. The Emerging Leaders of the Red River Valley are here today. And I thought I'd mention that a number of them, people who have been through that program, have served in the legislature. So you may be looking at prospective competition here, possibly.
Senator Eakin and Senator Dames brought that up. It's standing room only, and I did have the opportunity to meet a few of them in the hallway. And thank you all for being here, and thank you for recognizing both of you guys. With that, we're going to have a brief presentation from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. If you'd like to come forward and talk about the industrial hemp research report. And then following that, we'll have Senator Eakin's Senate File 618 will be before us. So,
good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anthony Cordelette with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I'm a research scientist who's been involved with and wrote the industrial hemp research report. I'd like to give you a brief overview of why we're at the stage we are right now with industrial hemp. As some of you may know, the Agricultural Act of 2014, or the Farm Bill, this past year created a provision that allowed state departments of agriculture to pursue the cultivation of industrial hemp if two things were met. Number one, that the purpose of the cultivation was for either research under some type of a pilot program or academic type of research. And number two, that state had some types of laws on the books that allowed for the cultivation of industrial hemp. A pilot program is defined under that federal law as any type of study that would be undertaken to look at the growth, cultivation, or marketing of industrial hemp. And finally, the federal farm bill also for the first time defined what industrial hemp is. And I'm sure most of you know that Cannabis sativa, which is the genus and species of the plant commonly referred to as marijuana, has many different names. It goes by marijuana, it goes by hemp, industrial hemp, wild hemp. And so in an effort to try to separate those two, which the Federal Controlled Substances Act doesn't do, it defines all marijuana, which is anything that's cannabis sativa, as being a Schedule I narcotic and illegal to possess. The Farm Bill actually gave a definition to what industrial hemp would and defined it as any cannabis sativa that contained 0.3% or less of THC, which is the acronym for the cannabinoid within the plant that produces the psychoactive effect that would be from smoking it or ingesting it. So this past year, the department was asked to provide a research report on sort of the interest in industrial hemp here in Minnesota amongst our institutions of higher education, and also to gauge how other states across the U.S. would be looking to pursue industrial hemp as it is provided now for within the federal farm bill. And so we conducted a report, and hopefully Acina was here for a handout. Most of you have that, where it was kind of an undertaking because we wanted to determine how do we, you know, accurately gauge how all the states are going to pursue this provision in federal law, and also how do we get the word out to all of the institutions of higher education as it was defined in Minnesota. And what we decided to do is use the National Plant Board for a vehicle to get the word out to all of the states and get some feedback from them. We designed a survey, and a fairly simple survey, to try to determine what actions they were planning to take, and then to do the get feedback from the institutions of higher education in Minnesota. We use the MNSCU system as well, the U of M system, and then also the Minnesota private colleges. And we sent another survey out to them, also brief, to try to gauge their interest in if they would, any researchers in those institutions would be pursuing the research of industrial hemp. And with that, I'll brief overview. I'll open it up to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much for being here today and updating us. Any questions for the witness members? Not. Thank you very much. That was exactly what we were looking for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Eakin, whenever you're ready, we'll have you present Senate File 618.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 618 is a bill dealing with hemp, industrial hemp, and allowing for the research of hemp here in Minnesota. As has already been testified to, the federal government in the 2014 Ag Bill did allow for the research of industrial hemp, and this simply conforms with that federal law and allows for that to take place here. I think it's important to note that industrial hemp, it's already been testified to, it cannot make you high. They already testified about the THC level, which is 0.3%, and marijuana, it's actually 5% to 20% THC levels. So The THC level in industrial hemp is so small that it would have no ability, to be impossible to be used for the purposes of making one high. And industrial hemp has been grown in the United States since the first European settlers arrived in the early 1600s. As a matter of fact, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams all grew industrial hemp and actively advocated for the commercial production of hemp. Hemp was a staple crop of the 1800s in American agriculture. There were actually towns that were even named after it, towns like Hempfield and Hempstead. And hemp was handled by the U.S. government like any other agricultural crop. Matter of fact, during World War II, about 150,000 acres of hemp were cultivated as part of the USDA's Hemp for Victory program during World War II. I have some products that are being sent around as well that are made from hemp. as I said, it's extremely versatile. It's used for food and for fuel and for fiber. You can make clothes with it. You can make food with it. You can make paper with it. A number of products that can be made from industrial hemp. And also, talking about the Hemp for Victory campaign that took place during World War II, there's actually a 4-H, I think that should be coming around as well, a hemp seed project for 4-H clubs that was being promoted at that time, teaching 4-H clubs how to produce and grow hemp for the war effort during World War II. Unfortunately, after World War II, there really was some confusion between marijuana and industrial hemp. In 1937, prior to the end of World War II here, 1937, the Marijuana Tax Act defined hemp as a narcotic drug. And after World War II, it was declared illegal. The Controlled Substances Act of 1970 adopted the same definition that was adopted in 37, which defined it as a narcotic drug. I think the best way to describe that is like having a cousin who's committed a crime that bears a significant resemblance to you, and you get thrown into jail along with them. I think that's what happened here, even though you didn't do anything wrong, just because you bore the resemblance. And
do you have a cousin?
Yeah. I'm the one doing something wrong, though. That's the problem. So, thank you. The confusion, I think it's important to note that at that time they didn't understand what caused the high, so they didn't know what the difference was between industrial hemp and marijuana. They didn't understand the difference in the levels of THC. And now we do. And as is already testified to, industrial hemp has been separated from marijuana. There is a definition now that if it's below 0.3%, that it qualifies as industrial hemp. So with that, I do have a couple of people here. I think it's one of the reasons we're trying to do this. Again, it just deals with the research. So it's got to go through the Ag Department, certification through the Ag Department, and it has to be in conjunction with the university doing research. So it would be very limited basis that we'd see the production of hemp being made here. There may be a possibility in the future that the federal government may act to open up for more large-scale production of industrial hemp. But at this time, this is a very limited scale of production, just done for research purposes. I think that it's important for us to move forward on this because it positions us well, especially if the federal government decides to open this up to more large-scale production. Minnesota is very well positioned as far as its land and the potential for growth here. During World War II, we were one of the biggest producers of industrial hemp. During that effort, I do think that there's some competition here. I think after World War II, the producers of cotton saw hemp as a very is a threatening competition to them, they were a very powerful lobby, of course. So I believe that that may have something to do with the fact that industrial hemp hasn't moved forward as quickly as it may have otherwise. And with that, I think it's important to note not only does it help the farmers by providing another commodity which they could produce here, but manufacturers also want to have it produced here in Minnesota. They are importing hemp-made products right now. The products that you see being passed around are imported products. We could be making them right here. So it would be a boon to manufacturing as well as to the ag sector. And manufacturing tends to follow the production. So if there's production taking place here in Minnesota, I think you would also see manufacturing being done here in Minnesota for the variety of products that industrial hemp is used for. And U.S. consumers are discovering the benefits of hemp now. In 2012, annual retail sales of hemp products was estimated at over $500 million. U.S. companies are producing popular and sustainable hemp foods, hemp body care products, hemp clothing, hemp paper, and much more. These companies want to purchase U.S.-grown hemp rather than rely on the more costly imports from places like Canada, which does produce industrial hemp, and China. And with that, I do have a couple of people who would like to testify on the bill as well.
Sure. Senator Eakin, let's have, I think, the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union is going to testify. While they're coming up, too, I believe you have an author's amendment that would get the bill in the shape that you prefer.
Yes, okay. And I would like to move that amendment.
Members understand that. Senator Eakin moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Gentlemen, welcome to committee. Whichever one would like to go first.
Okay.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Chairman. Members, for the record, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we strongly support Senate File 618, authored by Senator Eaker, which moves Minnesota forward to growing, cultivating, and harvesting, producing industrial hemp. Farmers Union has long supported hemp. Minnesota, as you heard, has had a long history of growing hemp. We were a leader in hemp production during World War II, and Senator Eakin mentioned one of my favorite videos. If you ever get on the YouTube, put in Hemp for Victory and watch the video that the U.S. government produced, because a lot of it is very like today, but it's worth watching. It's very interesting. When I first started with Farmers Union, I can't believe 13 years ago, and I think we've had this bill for 13 years too, so I just keep recycling my testimony. But when we go out and talk to our farmers on this issue, they'll always tell you where the hemp factories were too in World War II, and they'll, you know, and I've never run into people, especially farmers, that are not supportive of this issue. But as the senator said, the real game changer on this issue is the language that was part of the 2014 Farm Bill, which allows state agriculture departments, colleges, universities to grow hemp defined as non-drug oilseed fiber varieties of cannabis for academic or agricultural research purposes. And currently 19 states are in some kind of, have bills moving forward on this, or Kentucky and Colorado are already much farther along, and they have the test plots that are moving forward. And so I think that's an important part of this. And you can see the Section 21 has the pilot scale language. Farmers Union believes there's a tremendous interest in hemp. I think you heard all the possibilities: fiber, clothing, concrete. I think concrete is an interesting one. And I go back and I look through all my testimonies from 13 years. We keep adding things that are becoming more important. Concrete is really a growing one in other countries. China, Russia are the leaders in hemp production, but it's a low carbon emitter. Also, I think it's interesting is animal feed and animal bedding, too, is another one that I didn't used to see, but I see that in some countries now they're putting it into their beef and chicken mixes for their cattle. Hemp is typically grown in about 100 to 110 days, very similar to corn, although it uses very low inputs. A lot of the farmers I've talked to in Canada and in some of the test plots in Colorado, they don't use any or near very little fertilizers and pesticides. It generally does not also need the kind of water to grow to maturity. Generally, hemp is combined and baled. It's also chopped. There's a lot of it's really changed a lot in the years. It's getting a lot easier to harvest. Hemp, we also see it as how it's going to be grown eventually. This bill really starts with the pilot scale. But just say we were to move to like a fuller scale, you're going to see, we think, as it is in Canada, you're going to see niche grown and marketed. So an individual farmer growing it, processing it himself, or you're going to see a kind of a vertically integrated system. So a farmer company is going to set up shop in Twin Valley, and they're going to contract with local farmers there. They're not going to set up their shop in Twin Valley and contact with a farmer in Laverne or Redwood Falls. It's going to be close by, and they're going to kind of work it like that. That's what we see in Canada. In Canada, I kind of looked at the numbers, too, because I think it's interesting. If we had full-blown hemp, they grow anywhere from 10 to 50,000 acres a year. For example, Senator Eakin in Norman County, where he's from, they grow 100,000 acres of wheat. So it's going to be in certain areas, and it's a good opportunity, but it's not going to be everywhere. And as the senator said, it's really important, the millions of dollars that are being produced in Canada and other countries and then sold here, the products are being sold here in the United States where we could be doing that. We can buy the products and we can use them, and you see them all there. We just can't grow it and turn it into that. And that's what our farmers would like to see. Again, updating the research we feel is very important. I looked at like Colorado, who's moving forward on this. They're having issues with seed availability, and that's one thing they're really working on as they try to start growing their industry. Looking at equipment, soils, all those things are really important. This bill helps move forward. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Busselman?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for your record, Doug Busselman, Minnesota Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau policy also supports researching or developing a research initiative for industrial hemp as an alternative crop. Long-term, I think that as that research were to pay out or pan out and other kinds of changes would be brought about to make it legal for industrial hemp to be grown, we would also be in support of doing that with the proper safeguards. This bill gets us started in that whole process of developing a new alternative crop, and we strongly support the bill and encourage you to do so too.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the testifiers? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just one question that I have, and I signed on to the bill, but as because I recognize that industrial hemp did not give rise to a abuse of a substance, but in terms of the growing, is there a surefire way to determine if somebody wishes to plant in the middle of a field a couple rows of maybe a higher quality product? Are there safeguards in that scenario?
Senator Eakin?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, well, there's a safeguard built into the industrial hemp itself. The fact is that industrial hemp and marijuana will cross-pollinate because they are related. So would really destroy the THC levels and quality of the marijuana. So nobody wants to plant marijuana anywhere near industrial hemp. And the same thing is true with industrial hemp. It also reduces the quality of the industrial hemp, some of the qualities that you're looking for there if they cross-pollinate. So you're not going to be seeing marijuana and industrial hemp growing near each other.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Real quick, yep. Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Also, the bill and the way that it's going to be set up, you know, if it does go forward, you're going to have to be licensed. You'll be subject to inspection. You know, and so if a law enforcement were to come across a patch and it's not licensed and that's not a site, that's illegal. You know, and then and if you are a licensed grower, you're subject to inspection as well. So I think that's a good question, but that's what we've tried to address.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, and that'd be another reason, Senator Weber, you wouldn't want to be growing marijuana where you've got law enforcement officials, you know, doing the certification process or people that are doing the certification process.
Very good. Any other questions?
Throw it away from the police department.
If not, would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File
618.
Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 618 as amended be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Well, Senator Sparks, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'd like to take the last 20 minutes of our committee time just to start the discussion, as I said at the beginning of the meeting. Members, I do have an A1 author's amendment to try to bring some peace in the valley, and I would like to move that.
Senator Sparks, would you like to speak to it, or should we adopt it?
It would be an author's amendment.
Author's amendment. All right. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, aye.
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 Opposed, no. Amendment prevails. All right, Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair and members, many years ago, the legislature recognized possible issues that can arise between farm operators that create unavoidable noise and odor and their neighbors needed to live without unreasonable conditions. In the past, we've tried to remedy this through statute and the Pollution Control Agency rules by setting standards for noise and odor. The state, by setting these standards, has given direction to farmers on what they need to be doing to address these concerns. And it's if the farmer is meeting those obligations, they should not be subject to lawsuits for these issues. I would like to turn it over to my two testifiers, obviously, in the interest of time, to let them explain what we're trying to do here today. Obviously, with the amendment, I would turn it over to Mr. Perry, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I can give a short handout here.
Sure, we'll have a staff assist there. And, sir, if you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Jack Perry from the Briggs & Morgan Law Firm, and in the interest of time, there's a handout that goes through the 4 points of my justifications for these amendments. And the starting point to understand these amendments is 1997. And that's the 1997, the DFL passed what I consider, and based on historical research, a compromise bill to address the issue of odor feedlots and the impact on neighbors. And what the legislature did was basically came up with three different components of this compromise. The first one is that the legislature recognized that during the manure removal process in the fall of the year, basically mid-October, there is a time period when there is no way you can keep the odor levels under the state standards, which had already been passed. And so they passed a 21-day removal exemption from the state standards. The second thing that the legislature did was the legislature recognized that while livestock odor has a whole slew of different air emissions components, they singled out the most dominant one, the one that is most clearly attached to the offensive odor that people sense, and that's hydrogen sulfide. And so they made an express correlation between livestock odor and hydrogen sulfide levels. And the third thing they did was they restricted and directed the MPCA to monitor and respond to complaints and said to the MPCA, and I know they're in the audience here, Galen Reitz is over in the corner here, they said you can take enforcement action on any action, civil, criminal, whatever action, the full menu is before you to address livestock odor issues, but only if there is a violation of these hydrogen sulfide standards. In other words, this was a recognition that the operator, such as the man on the right, Mr. Fitzsimmons, these feedlots can't operate unless they can have the protection that they're not going to be sued or closed down by the agency, any other local government or neighbors by whatever suits are brought during the removal time period and if they're in compliance with the state standards. For the last 18 years, from 1997 till recently, that's the way it has played out. That's my point number two, paragraph number two on page number one. And in fact, the system has worked. And for facilities such as one that I represented a few years ago, Mr. Reitz came in and said, you guys got to come in compliance. They couldn't do it, and they were shut down. The system works. Point number two on page number two is we now face a threat where we're going back in time. And the Humane Society of the United States and some others have brought nuisance claims and other claims. And the claims essentially are trying to undo this compromise that was reached back in 1997. And specifically, what they're saying is the exemption during the fall, during the removal period, that only applies if the MPCA is taking regulatory actions against these feedlots. If you're a neighbor and they're in exceedance during that exemption period, you can bring a lawsuit and you can shut them down. And based on the other laws, you could easily shut down a facility. You cannot operate if that exemption doesn't apply. Second thing they said is these regulatory standards, they don't mean anything. They only mean something if the PCA comes after Mr. Fitzsimmons. Otherwise, they're irrelevant. Well, that's fine unless you have a multi-million-dollar facility and you're trying to find out, get investors to invest in it and trying to operate. It just doesn't work. But that's the stance that these different plaintiffs groups and national groups have taken. And we are fighting those in different fronts, several different fronts in the state. But the idea here is to bring it back to the body that tried to bring some semblance of common sense this back in 1997, and the industry has greatly appreciated that, and I think neighbors have appreciated that. I think Mr. Reitz told me before this, they've only had 35 complaints in the last umpteen years. Galen can clarify that. But there isn't a big issue. These are national groups coming in here trying to upset the compromise. So point number three on page number three is really the two questions that we have for this board. Our first one of this committee is, does the legislature continue to support and stand behind this three-part legislative compromise as it was intended and has been and continues to be enforced by the Pollution Control Agency for the last nearly two decades? Question number two, if so, will the legislature clarify the scope of this three-part legislative compromise so that it applies as it was intended and has been and continues to be enforced by the Pollution Control Agency for the last nearly two decades? And point number four is simply going through the laundry list of the clarifications. There is no intent in any of this by the author, I don't believe, and certainly not by Mr. Fitzsimmons or myself, to change the statute. We are simply trying to clarify what the legislative history suggests was the intent. The intent is that the standards that the legislature passed or forced the MPCA to pass in 1967, they mean something. That is the standard that we are to comply with. The livestock odor standards that were adopted in 1997, which adopted the hydrogen sulfide as a proxy, those mean something. If you comply with those, you're okay. If you're not, God bless you, you're in trouble. That's all we're trying to do. Those are two points of clarification. And with that said, if we have any more time left, if Mr. Fitzsimmons.
Yeah, I'd like to. My name is Paul Fitzsimmons. I'd like to thank the committee for the chance to speak. Just a quick little family background. I'm from a family of nine siblings who are all in the business together out of Mapleton, Minnesota. So we all work in the production agriculture every day together. We own a company called Protein Sources. The background on that, it has about 280 employees. Most of them are in the livestock production phase. And those 280 employees really make up what is the fabric of southern Minnesota in our area, in all the small towns and communities across southern Minnesota. So I have a great commitment to the industry in which I make my living, and our family has made their living for the last 100 years. And that commitment is that we have always done what is best, not only for the environment, but for everything that we do to make sure that we are the standard for which other livestock industries that we're up against and compete. So we're committed to delivering the best product we can to our consumers, and also for the best product at a cost that everybody can afford. And so that's part of our commitment to this agriculture, to our livestock industry. But what we're talking about is not just an issue for the pork producers, of which I'm one. It's an issue for all livestock feedlots across Minnesota. Our industry needs certainty. So in the past 10 years, I've helped permit facilities across Minnesota. And those permits take anywhere from a year to 2 years to get permitted as you go through townships, counties, and state regulations. And I think since 1997, when these rules were enacted, going all the way back to 82, our industry has been very, very proactive, working with the University of Minnesota, working with outside engineers, and a lot of the research that was done was actually funded by producers. And so we have found that we can, within the guidelines, we can run our industries and be very, very friendly. What we're asking here is, I probably have a couple more projects that are on the books. I don't think if we're going to go through nuisance suits after you've went through the 2 years of permitting and have never, ever went over the standards that are set, that I could really look somebody in the face and say Minnesota's the place to build. Because I think this is the new frontier for how animal agriculture is going to be attacked in Minnesota. So to fix this, and it's really not a fix. It was enacted by the both houses, and it's really just a something to make sure that when the MPCA, when we get those stamps of approval of every one of those the township, the county, and the Minnesota state, that they do mean something, and that we're free to go and do our business, run our business, and in the communities where we're at, and supply those jobs for rural Minnesota. And that's really where we're at. But I can see this as a snowball effect if we don't get something done, because it's the new attack on animal agriculture in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, can I ask him one question?
You sure can.
Mr. Fitzsimmons, I made the comment that I'm a lawyer, so I have no business making it, but the comment was that you guys cannot stay in compliance with these state standards during the removal time period, the necessary removal period in the fall, if you're not exempt. Is that correct or incorrect?
Yes, because the measurements are made at the property lines. So if we're applying on fields at the agronomic rates that we need to apply, we're going to be up next to the fence line of the neighbor. So there's absolutely no way that we would be able to comply. And again, that's not just pork producers. That's every animal industry that we're handling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Fitzsimmons. Do we have any initial questions among the committee? All right. Another testifier here. Would you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Preisler. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. I just want to build on some of the comments from Mr. Fitzsimmons. You know, our organization is also, and our members are committed to compliance with state standards, and this bill doesn't change, again, state standards or enforcement. I want to take a brief moment, though, to talk about really kind of what's at risk here. If we look at Minnesota agriculture as a whole, generates, if we look at the last couple of years on a per-year basis, generates about $21 billion for Minnesota's economy, so $21 billion. Of that, 40% of that $21 billion is directly from livestock. And so whether it's hogs or milk or cattle or turkeys, we happen to rank number one in turkeys in the U.S. We're number two in hogs, number seven in dairy. And so overall, if we look at revenue that comes from livestock products, we're actually ranked seventh in the United States. And it employs people. And so as we look at that, there's well over 120,000 folks that are employed directly on farms or in our processing plants, and that doesn't even count the indirect employment and the support jobs. And I think one of the things that Mr. Fitzsimmons said that's really important is that if we're going to be subjected to this nuisance risk is starting to become more common, it just really starts to make it difficult for people to make that decision to make an investment in Minnesota. Ironically, we've got our two neighboring states of North Dakota and South Dakota really trying to bend over backwards to figure out how they're going to attract livestock back to their states. For example, North Dakota has 90 dairy farms left in the whole state of North Dakota. They're going through a whole change in their corporate farm law to attract folks back. We're not asking for a change in corporate farm law. We're asking the ability of basically families here in Minnesota to be able to just basically do their business, be in compliance with state law, but then do their business, and not to have this risk hanging over them from a nuisance standpoint that you just really can't control. With that, I want to stay brief, and so thank you very much for your attention and stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Preisler. Any initial questions among the committee?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I know that I think Mr. Carlson wants to speak, and I've visited with him about it. We really are trying to drill down and get to that 21-day cleanout. You know, a couple years back, members will remember that we passed through the Department of Agriculture some regulation for those applicators to try to make that as safe as possible. And for members from the rural area, you really realize that in the fall of the year, that fertilizer is like gold to those local farmers. And so I think this is a big deal. And so we're trying to shine some light on it, trying to find some common ground here. But obviously, we know we have a little work left to do. But I think that if Mr. Carlson would like to come, and anyone else that wants to testify certainly can. Or if you have questions for the members, you're welcome to do that too.
All right. Well, without any questions from the committee, if Mr. Carlson could approach the witness stand, please. And in the interest of time, if there's anyone else who would like to speak against this bill, Ms. Goodwin, you can approach the witness table as well. Mr. Carlson, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I appreciate my second visit to the Agriculture Committee this year.
Welcome back.
Thank you. As you know, our members represent people who are injured through the acts of others, and we do have lawyers that have been involved in a number of these cases. And our position is that this is not a clarification of the law, but is a pretty substantial departure from what the current law is as it relates to nuisance actions. And I've had a chance to share that with Senator Sparks, but our law defines in Chapter 561, defines a nuisance as anything that is injurious to your health, is indecent, offensive to your senses, or interferes with our use or comfortable enjoyment of our life. And a citizen or a company, many of these claims are brought by other companies, has a right to bring a nuisance action in Minnesota, and it's been the law for over 100 years, to abate the nuisance. That's what most of these claims are about, is to try and abate the problem so that they can enjoy their property and live in harmony. There are two types of nuisances that are affected by the language, both a public nuisance where the agency, whether it's a city, a county, or the state, would take an action to enforce an ordinance, or a private nuisance. Both are impacted by the language of the bill. We mostly are concerned about the private nuisance actions. And I think it's important to remember that it doesn't need to be an illegal activity that can interfere with your use and enjoyment of your property or injurious to your health. And I get the idea of compliance, but you need to know many of these are odor related, and Minnesota does not have an odor standard. We did have an odor standard at one point, and it was repealed by the MPCA in about 1998. So we don't really have an odor standard. We do have a hydrogen sulfide standard that they can monitor, but we don't have an odor standard. So being in compliance is great, but we don't have an odor standard either on-site or off-site that they can really measure this against. The last point I want to make, Mr. Chairman and members, is at least in four different places in the bill, this impacts and goes in and affects cases that are currently in litigation. If you look at the language in the bill, for instance, on lines 2.4, it impacts a pending or future case. A pending or future case, it's listed four times. That is clearly a departure from where this legislature has been, to go in and apply the law to a case that is currently being litigated. We have serious concerns, not about that just in this bill, but as a precedential issue as well. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions. And I know this is a sensitive issue, and communities want these operations to be successful. They also want to live in harmony with their neighbors. And that's really sometimes the only thing a nuisance action can do, is bring about an abatement. So appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman, and having the chance to speak to the author about the bill.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. In the interest of time, if we could go directly to your testimony, Ms. Goodwin, and if you don't mind, keep your remarks as brief as you possibly can. We're already over our time limit.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing me today.
And if you can state your name for the record.
I'm Amy Goodwin.
Thank you.
I'm Amy Goodwin. I am a registered voter here in Minnesota. I currently live in Todd County, or in Douglas County. I used to live in Todd County. I am here today to speak against the Senate file 482. I'm speaking from the perspective of the people. I'm not supporting anyone, or I'm just here of my own accord today. So I thank you for hearing me. So our experience with facility farming started a couple of years ago, and we owned 33 acres in the county in which we lived. We had lived there all of our married lives. We have four children there. It was a beautiful wooded place in northern Minnesota, and we loved it. It was our dream home. When we first heard about this facility coming to our neighborhood, we were not against it. We didn't really know anything about agriculture or faculty farming. And we had been surrounded. We had two hog farmers that were within a mile of our home that had been there the entire time we lived there, almost 20 years, and a large dairy farm just down the road from our house. We coexisted with these agricultural farms our entire lives. My husband grew up on a dairy farm, so I just want to establish that we are in no way against agriculture. We are a big, it's a big part of our lives in central Minnesota. So when we started to learn more about this facility, the size of it, the close proximity it was going to be to neighbors, we became concerned. And so we started to do a little bit of our own research. There are, just for your information, in our situation, there were 6 homes, families, that reside within a half a mile of this facility. And the facility is a massive facility, 4,000 hog unit. And so that was our concern. And in my research, I came across many things that, you know, were concerning to me. But the most concerning thing to me was the impact that the size of these facilities can have on somebody who is, particularly children, and who have respiratory issues or heart issues. I happen to have 2 sons with asthma, and I have asthma myself. And so this was a big concern for me. And so I became involved in actively trying to keep this facility out of our neighborhood. We started out trying to, you know, really work with these owners. They were an Iowa-based business. They were coming to Minnesota by their own admission of not being able to raise healthy hogs in Iowa anymore. And my father-in-law, who is a well-established, well-known farmer in Todd County, even contacted them, said, hey, we have a lot of land in this area that people are not for miles. You know, there's no water nearby. Let's check it out. We'll help you find a new place. But they were not compromising. So the bill went through after spending a lot of time, or not the bill, I'm sorry, but the CUP went through. And we didn't want to leave our home. We had lived in our home for 18 years. We'd raised all of our children there. Our children had, played out in the woods. That's where they grew up. That's where all their memories were. So we decided to wait and see what happened. So the animals were brought into the facility sometime the end of June, beginning of July. And we started noticing the effects on our youngest boy with asthma by August. And it was a very short time until he was completely dependent on his inhalers and steroid nebulizers to keep him breathing clearly. So by December, all of my children had developed a hacky cough, all of my three of my 4 children, that they just couldn't get rid of. And it would be better when they were at school, but when they were at home, they were miserable. My sons with asthma were miserable. And I don't know if any of you have experienced this, but my son had such an episode with asthma that his lips turned blue and he couldn't breathe. It's a 20-minute ride to the hospital. And I'm sorry. After that, we stopped fighting to stay in our home because home was not a safe place for our son anymore. I'm sorry. So risking financial ruin, we put our house up for sale, and we moved. We bought a home, and we moved, and we paid 2 mortgages for 7 months, which was a stress more than I can convey to you, but it was nothing compared to the concern that we had for our son, whose health has dramatically improved since we've been away from there. So I am here today speaking for the people, that there is 2 sides to every story. And the people have been hurt in this situation. And they say you should never show your enemy your weakness, but the truth is they've really hurt us. They've not just hurt my family, but they've hurt several other families who are moving or struggling to stay. And if this bill passes, it will continue to hurt us, and it will hurt others like us. People who are Minnesota residents, people who are voters in Minnesota, people who love the place that we live. So this bill will hurt us, and we're asking that you do not pass it, that you stop it.
Well, thank you, Ms. Goodwin, for taking the time to share that story with us today. And I know Senator Sparks had mentioned earlier that he's committed to continue to work on this bill and take into account concerns that were raised today in committee. With that said, are there any questions around the table among board members or committee members? All right. With that, Ms. Goodwin?
I have copies, if anyone would want, of my testimony.
Oh, very well. Okay, well, thank you for that. With time running out today, folks, we are going to move to close here. And with that said, we will that completes the business for the day, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.